Good morning, everybody. It's a real pleasure to welcome you to the Oxford Particle Physics Christmas Lecture. We are one of the largest particle physics group in the UK, and we have international reputation, and we are playing a leading role in many experiments from the Large Hadron Collider to neutrino physics to the search for dark matter and dark energy. Before introducing our speaker, I would like to give you a very quick overview of our science and what we have done, what have been doing the last year. So in 2019, the Large Hadron Collider was actually stopped, and we were doing like a lot of, at CERN, there were a lot of refurbishing of the injector that are accelerating the protons in order to inject them in the Large Hadron Collider. And also, there is a lot of activities. There is a movie here that I cannot show because we had some computer problems this morning, and so I had to put my presentation in Francis' computer. But again, we are opening, for example, this movie shows the opening of the door, if you want, of ATLAS in order to do also some, a lot of improvement in ATLAS. And there is a lot going on also in LHCb, one of the other experiments that we do at the Large Hadron Collider. So in, actually you can see the movie here starting on its own. Yeah, you can see that they are removing they are removing the shielding and opening up the cavern so that we can access the experiment and do in the ATLAS experiment and do the improvement that we have planned during LS2. So in 2019, we have really focused to study the Higgs boson. And really, the Higgs boson, it's really doing what is expected to do in the standard model. It is coupling and giving the mass to the W and the Z boson, the carrier of the electroweak interaction. And it's also displaying this new interaction, which is called the Yukawa coupling, that is this non-universal coupling that is proportional to the mass of the particles. This graph shows you the coupling versus the mass of the particles. And just as a quick reminder, you know, the particles are divided in first generation, second generation, and third generation, and the masses of the particle in the various generations, up, down, quark, electron, electron neutrino, charm, strange, muon, muon neutrino, top, bottom, tau, tau neutrino, and WZ and the Higgs, of course. So you can see that the masses of the various quarks and leptons in the various generations increase. And in fact, this non-fundamental coupling, that is the Yukawa coupling, does increase with the mass of the particle, which was predicted by the standard model. And as you can see here, the star, the Oxford blue star, are the contribution of our student to this graph. And you see that we have contributed to the coupling to the Z, to the W, to the B quark, and we are now starting to explore the coupling to the second generation, to the muon, which is very tiny and is very difficult to measure, but we expect to measure it soon at the Large Hadron Collider. Of course, in ATLAS, we continue to look for new things. So here is just an event to show you, we don't see quarks in our experiment. We see jets that remember the direction of the initial quark produced in the hard scattering between the protons. And you can see here the highest mass dijet event, which has an energy, a mass of 8 trillion electron volts. So this is truly amazing. As you know, the law of physics predicts that in the Big Bang, we had the same amount of matter and antimatter in the universe. So one of the ingredients to go from the universe at the beginning to the universe that we have now, which is dominated by matter, is a violation of a charge conjugation, when you change the particle to its antiparticle, and parity, which is when you look at an interaction in a mirror. And so CP symmetry will state that the law of physics is the same for particle and antiparticle, and they are the same for parity, under parity inversion. But again, we know already since 1964 that particles that contain the strange quark like the kaon violate CP violation. This was discovered by a famous experiment by Kroning and Fitch, which got the Nobel Prize in 1980. And over the year, we have seen CP violation in the quark sector, also in the B sector, for example. And just this year, the LHCb experiment has discovered a new place where you have CP violation, which is a CP violation in the charm sector. This is an extremely beautiful measurement. They have studied the decay of D0, which are mesons that contain the charm quark, to kaons and to pions, and they compare what happened for D0 with D0 bar, which are the antiparticle of the D0, and they looked at millions of this event, and they find this tiny effect at the 10 to the minus 4 level, showing that CP is violated also in the charm sector. It's a very small amount, and it matches the prediction of the standard model, and is not enough to explain why the universe is dominated by matter today. So we are now looking at CP violation in a different sector, which is the neutrino sector, and one of the experiments that we do is actually in Japan, and to see CP violation, we have neutrino beams produced at JPARC in Japan, which are an anti-neutrino beam, which are directed towards the mountain in this region of Japan, where in a mountain you have the Super Kaiomekanda experiment. So you have a lot of water surrounded by photodetectors that enable you to see the Cherenkov light deposited by neutrino and anti-neutrinos in these detectors. To really find if antineutrino are different from neutrino, you have to measure the flux with amazing precision. And one of our students this year has improved the certainty in this measurement by a factor of 2. And this is extremely interesting, actually, because in T2K, this experiment, we plot here as a neutrino, here as an antineutrino, and the dots as experimental measurement. And you can see that actually the prediction without CP violation are not in agreement with the data as the one with CP violation. So we should really keep watching this because it's really a very promising result. So we are very excited about neutrinos. They are really particles that always provide a lot of surprises. And we have two big experiments under construction where Oxford is playing a big leadership. One in the US, which is called DUNE, where the neutrino and anti-neutrino beam will shine from Chicago, from Fermilab, towards a mine in South Dakota, and where they will be instrumented by a really huge detector. And so at the moment, they've started the excavation, which means that you have to take away, 8,000 tons of rock to be excavated to do the detector, to put the detector to detect the neutrino, 1.5 kilometers underground. It's truly amazing, okay? And Oxford is leading the project in the UK, and we are providing the data acquisition that will take the data from the cavern to the surface. The detector here are really huge. Here is a prototype detector under construction at CERN, which is called ProtoDUNE. You can see here the size of a person. So these are really amazing. It will be an amazing project when it will be finished. And the same in Japan. In Japan, again, the beam will be from JPARC on this side of Japan, and then it will shown to the mountains where you will have a new detector, which is called Hyper Kaiomekanda, which will be half a megaton of water in this cavern. So a truly amazing project. We are also studying neutrino at SNOW, SNOW Plus actually now. If you know, SNOW got an experiment that was filled with 1,000 tons of heavy water and was instrumental to discover neutrino oscillation. And this yielded the Nobel Prize in 2015. And now SnowPlus was filled with water in 2018, and it allows the most precise measurement of nucleon decay up to now. You can see here some of the results that were recently published. But the most interesting thing is that now the experiment is being filled with scintillator loaded with tellurium in order to understand if neutrino has the same particle as their own antiparticle, indicating that neutrino are not Dirac particle, but Majorana particle. This is really the next one of the big questions about neutrinos. And Oxford has developed this technique, and we've done a lot of study to understand how to load tellurium in this detector. So also LZ, this is another experiment that is studying dark matter, and this year, you know, the experiment has been completed on the surface, and the experiment has started its travel underground again in the same mine in South Dakota where Dune will be installed. So you can see how our amazing, you know, scope and the wideness of the physics that we cover. Apart from participating in the experiment, we also have an institute as part of particle physics, which is called the John Adam Institute. It's named after one of the directors of CERN. So the John Adams is a search of excellence for advanced and novel accelerator techniques, providing expertise, research development, and training the next generation of accelerator physicists. So as part of the John Adams, we are leading the construction, the understanding of how we could construct and build the new detectors, the new colliders that we need to advance in particle physics. And as you can see, we have a lot of possibility on the table, and we are currently trying to understand which one will be the one that we will choose. One of them is CLIC, which will be constructed in phases. The first phase is about 10 kilometers, and CLIC is an electron-positron collider, and it will reach 380 GeV. The second phase is about 30 kilometers in length, and it will reach 1.5 TeV. And the final, phase is 50 kilometers, and it will reach 3 TeV. Another plus and minus collider has been under design in Japan, and we should know very soon if the Japanese will go ahead with it. But CERN is also preparing for what is called the future circular collider, which will be, again, an amazing facility. It will be, here is LHC, which is a 27 kilometer collider, and here is the FCC, a 100 kilometer collider that first will host E plus E minus collision and then proton-proton collision, again, to reach 100 TeV, the highest energy that ever in the world. So again, as I told you, we don't know yet which one of these projects will be chosen. They are all very expensive, actually, as you can imagine. But we are also building the new detectors for the upgrade of the LHC that will start in 2025. And so we are both building the pixel detectors and the strip detector for the new tracker of Atlas, and we are also building a lot of the upgrade for the LHCb experiment here. So now, before concluding, I would like to show you a few of the awards that have been given to our faculty this year. Alan Barr has received the Vice Chancellor Public Engagement with Research Award in 2019. He has developed a program of citizen science where citizens, especially young students, are going to look at the data of the LHC and study the Higgs boson. And this was an event where you can see the student presenting their result at CERN. And Ian Shipsey, the head of physics, has received the Chadwick Medal for his elucidation of the physics of heavy quarks, the development of the enabling instrumentation, and the leadership of scientific collaborations. Again, not only our faculty receive awards. This is one of our students, is here, Mia Subic. And he has received the Artificial Intelligence Impact Award from the Oxford Foundry. And this group of students from Oxford has built a solution to present the perils of bias in, bias out in AI-driven recruitment tools. The team won this award, and they were they won a week-long trip to California Palm Springs to share their experience with other teams around the world. So, Merry Christmas to everybody in particle physics. And our present is really the Christmas lecture that we have today. I can only say that I'm really delighted to have Francis here in Oxford. He is very distinguished. He's a Hillsdale and Gregory Braid professor at Wisconsin, has received many prizes. I just read a few. He has received the Balzan Prize, the European Physics Society Prize for Particle Astrophysics and Cosmology, the Smithsonian American Ingenuity Award for Physical Sciences in 2014, the Physics World Breakthrough of the Year Award for making the first observation of cosmic neutrino in 2013. He is an advisory role in many experiments in SNOW, Auger, to the Max Planck, to the ICSR Institute in Tokyo, to the US Particle Physics Prioritization Panel, to APEC, which is a particle astrophysics advisory panel in Europe. He's a member also of the Fermilab PSC. He wrote the book where I study my particle physics, and you all, the Olsen and Martin. And as you know, I mean, you always have a certain amount of, you know, it's always nice to meet the people that wrote the book where you study. And I think that what is more amazing, and you will hear about it today in his lecture, is that he is really a true explorer. He has really enabled a new part of physics. On July 12th of 2018, the IceCube collaboration announced the observation of a 290 TV neutrino and traced it back to a small patch of the Orion constellation, where you had the activities of a black hole known as Blazar TXS0506. And this was really the birth of a new kind of astronomy, where we have a new messenger which can help us study the universe. So please welcome Francis Olsen today. And
so it's a pleasure to be here. I actually gave the first lecture ever given in this theater. I gave the Sherwell lecture. I don't remember the year, but it's a long time ago. And I remember that in the middle of the lecture, all the electronics failed. And I became an experimentalist in 30 seconds. But I'm still a theorist. I almost feel this is not appropriate for a Christmas lecture, because we'll have to go on a long ride to a lot of topics to cover neutrino astronomy. I will tell you first what neutrino astronomy is, then I will tell you what IceCube is, then I will tell you how we discovered cosmic neutrinos, and then we'll discuss what this actually means. And it's a pleasure to give this talk, because I'm talking to particle physicists, or at least physicists mostly. And so, you know, I share this talk with people like me who don't know any astronomy. So we'll have to, although this lecture in principle is about astronomy, so I'll gently introduce astronomy. I'll first show you this slide, because you probably recognize the microwave background. And I have to remind you that the universe is not empty. There are 411 microwave photons per cubic centimeter in the universe. This will be very important in this talk. Then what you have to know about astronomy is that you can change the energy of the photon, or its wavelength, or its color. And so if I go to 1 electron volt photons, that's what the sky looks like. And this is to remind you, I will always use this projection of the universe And so our own galaxy is the major axis of this ellipse. That's where we live, somewhere there. Then you can increase, of course, we are mostly interested, we cannot relate to 1 eV photons. But so this is something we can relate to. This is the sky in 1 GeV photons. If you detect 1 GeV photons, the sky looks like this, and you see how bright our own galaxy is. And then you say, well, keep playing this game, right? That's what you do with accelerators. So you go to 10 to the 16 electron volts, and this is what the sky looks like. You see nothing. And that's interesting, actually, because it means if you list the wavelengths of light and you go through all the wavelengths or energies, it means you come to a barrier where we have never seen the universe. And you say, well, how do you know there's something there? We know there's something there because we have actually seen cosmic rays that extend all the way to 10 to the 20th electron volts. But we have never seen, it's like the dark side of the moon. And so why is this? What's the physics? It's very simple. If you take this object very far away, it's a particle accelerator that accelerates the cosmic rays we see. And it probably, hopefully, also emits photons. And so if you want to do astronomy with the photons, they never get here. Because remember, there are 411 microwave photons per cubic centimeter. So that photon will interact with one of these CMB photons, produce an electron-positron pair, and astronomy is finished. You cannot do astronomy with charged particles. You know, this source probably produced the protons we see at 10 to the 20th electron volt. We know these particles exist for more than a century. We have no clue where or how they are accelerated. And that is because they are charged. So they are bent in the magnetic field of the Earth, of our galaxy, magnetic fields outside the galaxy. So they may have been produced there, and we detect them there. So they don't tell us where they come from, and the photons don't get here. So it's an old idea that goes back to the 50s, and nobody really knows the origin of that. Of course, you can solve all of this with neutrinos. Neutrinos reach us without being touched by magnetic fields or anything else from the beginning of time and from the edge of the universe. So they are really the ideal messenger. And they are identical to photons. In this talk, neutrinos have no mass. It's totally irrelevant. The energies we are talking about are so high is that the mass they have is doesn't play any role. So they are exactly like light. The only problem is that they are difficult to detect. And they have another interesting property. This talk is going to be concentrated on the topic of finally finding the sources of cosmic rays. And so, as everybody in this audience knows, neutrinos are produced by pions, kaons that decay. And to produce pions and kaons, you need protons. And so you only will see neutrinos from sources that have proton beams, cosmic rays in this context. So if you make a map of the sky in neutrinos, you not only see the sources of cosmic rays, you only see the sources of cosmic rays. Now, it's, you know, I have to start by showing this slide and, showing how far this beam extends. And but what I am really interested in is this very high energy part of the cosmic ray spectrum. This tells you how many cosmic rays reach us from the universe. In fact, it starts with the sun on the left and with the 10 to the 21 electron volt I'm talking about here. By the way, that's 100 million TeV for those who cannot relate to electron volts. And so the real fascination for us, most of us on this experiment, I think there's one from the 300 people, there's one astronomer on this experiment. You know, I have to admit the only reason we are fascinated by this is that we want to know how nature constructs these accelerators and what they are. I remember when an experiment in Utah detected a particle that had the energy of 300 million TeV in 1991. So if you give me LHC magnets, I have to fill the orbit of Mercury to accelerate that particle. So I don't think that's how nature does it. But so how are cosmic rays accelerated? Well, if you think a little bit about the problem, you will see it's dramatic that they get this high energy. But if you look at the luminosity of the accelerators, it's very high as well. And so it's a real challenge to think of anything that can accelerate these cosmic rays. And so the only idea is that somewhere in the universe, you have to look for some huge amount of gravitational energy. And then you invent a mechanism that somehow transforms 1% of this energy into accelerating particles. That's called shock waves. And that's the last time I mentioned this subject. It's not appropriate for Christmas. And so where do you find a huge amount of gravitational energies? Stars that collapse. And so this is the standard model of cosmic ray physics. This is a star that collapsed a few hundred years ago. It leaves a neutron star, and then the shock wave expanding in the interstellar medium. You see these filaments there. That's where particles are accelerated in shocks. This can explain the cosmic rays in our own galaxy. The cosmic rays outside our galaxy, this doesn't work. But what does work is if you have a star that's more than 8 solar masses, it will collapse in a black hole. And then it will do the same thing. You saw the movie of it. The only thing is that you can get to higher energies, 300 million TeV, at least dimensionally. And it looks a bit different because the black hole is spinning, so it makes a beam of particles. It's not symmetric like this picture. That's in every textbook. The only problem is there's no evidence for this. None whatsoever. And so are there other ideas? There's one other idea, maybe one and a half. I won't talk about the half one. But this, remember, you need huge amount of gravitational energy. Well, this is a galaxy, almost like ours. It has a black hole at the center, like ours. And the only difference is that this black hole is active. And so it's eating its own galaxy. And you have huge amounts of matter flowing onto that black hole. And so you have flows of particles, just like in an exploding star, in this what's called the accretion disk and this jet. And so you can set up shocks and accelerate particles. In this talk, the jet will actually play an important role. This galaxy has a magnetic field like ours. And in some magic way, in one turn of the black hole, it will wind up the magnetic field and shoot it off perpendicular to its rotation, along its rotation axis, and produce like a particle beam. And so here is where I'm going to enter the neutrinos. So imagine, let's think about this jet. If it's a cosmic ray source, it will accelerate protons. And these protons will move along the jet. But this black hole is surrounded by a mess of dust and light. You know, all this stuff flowing into the black hole will radiate and create huge radiation fields, like typically 10 electron volt photons. And so this proton will interact with one of these photons, make pion. The pion will decay into a muon and a muon neutrino, and the muon will further decay in an electron and neutrinos. So these are the neutrinos we want to detect, and then we know we have detected a proton accelerator. Now, to bring this closer to home, this is how you make a neutrino beam at CERN. You have an accelerator, you shoot it, I think it was in a block of steel, and the proton makes pions, it makes the pions decay, the neutrinos come out, and everything else actually is pretty much absorbed in the target that makes your pions. This is what's called a beam dump. And so we are looking for beam dumps in the sky. So it's exactly the same. You tap the electromagnetic energy of a black hole or a neutron star to accelerate particles. They are surrounded by dust, molecular clouds, radiation, and so you have target to produce neutrinos. And so the physics is well known. P plus gamma gives a neutron and a pi plus. The pi plus makes a neutrino. But remember, it also makes proton pi zero. The pi zero decays in two gamma rays. And these gamma rays will have similar energy to the neutrinos. So this will be an important topic in this talk. So now the question is, if you want to see cosmic accelerators, how big an experiment do you need? How big a neutrino detector? And I like to show this slide, because it was presented at a conference in 2012, and we had built IceCube. It was working for 2 years. We had seen nothing. And that's when you begin to worry. And so we showed this slide, okay. And so what it shows is that theorists for a couple of decades had tried to estimate the size of the detector. And they had all agreed that the size was 1 km³. You would detect 10 to 100 events per year if you build a fully efficient 1 km³ neutrino detector. So what does this slide, what do you see here? Well, first of all, this is the flux of neutrinos. This tells you how many neutrinos your experiment will see. But I've multiplied this flux by energy square, because these accelerators, they don't produce monochromatic beams. They produce beams that where the number of particles falls as 1/the energy. And so when I multiply by energy square, then the predictions of the theorists fall on a horizontal line. And you can see there are the predictions, supernova remnants. These are the things I showed on this slide, the exploding stars. There are the gamma ray bursts. That's the one thing you saw the movie on, and this I will not talk about. These were called the so-called guaranteed neutrinos, which we have never seen. So what's the rest on this slide? Well, this is the bad news. That's the atmospheric neutrino flux. So the same cosmic rays, which we know and love, will enter our atmosphere, interact with nitrogen and oxygen, make pions, and pions make neutrinos and muons. And so these are called atmospheric neutrinos and atmospheric muons. All the physics is the same as what I described before. And you see, this is a logarithmic scale. So if you look up at the sky, you see neutrinos all the time. You know, as I stand here, IceCube sees a neutrino every 5 minutes. And it are these neutrinos. So it's like you are looking up at the sky and you see a cloud of neutrinos, except the cloud never goes away. And so that's the bad news. The good news is that we have measured this atmospheric neutrino beam over many orders of magnitude, which calibrates the experiment. Remember, we know how to measure energy, which is important for the rest of the talk. And then the other good news is, if you come here to this 100 TeV, that's the demarcation line. You see this flux disappears. And if you manage to detect a neutrino well above 100 TeV, it cannot come from the atmosphere. And so you can make a discovery with one event, which we did, as I will show you. So remember the magic number, 100 TeV. How do you detect neutrinos? Well, you saw, you probably all know about this experiment. You need water and photomultipliers, light detectors. This is the Super Kamiokande experiment in the Japanese Alps. And it's a beautiful experiment. The problem with it is, if you relate it to the previous slide, it's 10,000 times too small. And so you have to build something that's 10,000 times bigger, and that's what we did. It's called IceCube. How to do this was actually known since 1960. This is Moshe Markov, and I will not tell you what he said, but this is his idea. You go somewhere deep in the water, in the ocean, in a lake, and you instrument a volume of water with light detector, photomultiplier tubes. Then you detect neutrinos that are coming through the Earth. If you detect a particle coming through the Earth, it can only be a neutrino. No other particles can come through the Earth. What does it do? Well, it just goes through your detector. But at the energies, the magic 100 TeV, about 1 in 1,000,000 will crash into a nucleus. It doesn't see an atom, but it sees nuclei. And then what it will do is it will produce charged particles with physics that we all understand and love, a standard model of particle physics. And these particles are charged, so they will produce light in the water. And if this is a muon neutrino, it will create a muon, and a muon at these energies travels through the water for kilometers, tens of kilometers at very high energy. So you can actually detect them outside your instrumented volume. But also, when they travel through your detector, they will emit light. The muon travels at a speed of light. The light in the water travels at 3/4 of the speed of light. So it's like a speedboat that outruns the waves, and it makes a bow shock. And so if your photomultipliers can identify the shape of the Cherenkov cone, this is what it's called, then you know the direction of the muon, and you know the direction of the neutrino, and you not only have a detector, you have a telescope, because you know where the neutrino came from. So remember, the IceCube is detecting neutrinos in the sky above Oxford. So, I think I said all that. So, people tried this in the 70s. They tried to construct an experiment like this, 25 kilometers off the coast of Hawaii. And you see here a photomultiplier tube that's about to go, I think, 4 kilometers deep in the water. The experiment failed. In fact, it never got the funding to really succeed. And these people discovered a lot of the techniques that we are still using today. There was an experiment in Lake Baikal that actually did succeed, but it never became big enough to see cosmic neutrinos. And so the technology to do this in water has been developed by the Antares experiment in the Mediterranean. They built a small detector like we did originally. We built something called Amanda and demonstrated techniques. So our idea was, in the late 80s, when we saw how difficult it was to deploy a detector in water, our idea, and this is only the good idea we had, all the rest was luck, as you will see. was that it was actually, it's a counterintuitive idea, it's easier to put a photomultiplier kilometers deep in natural Antarctic ice than to put it in water. And so that's what we did. Here you see, that's the geographic South Pole. So you're in the middle of Antarctica. And what made this experiment possible is that there is a research station there with cranes, bulldozers, everything. There is a runway, so everything comes in by plane. And there is the Ice Cube project. And the luck we had is when we, of course, we started by looking if you could turn ice in a particle detector. This took about 10 years of R&D. And we found this fantastically clear ice once you were below 1.5 kilometers. You cannot construct in a lab a piece of material that's more transparent to blue light than this ice. And so that was our luck. And so we built a detector just by deploying photomultipliers 1.5 kilometers, between 1.5 and 2.5 kilometers, to just do this physics. So we filled a kilometer cube with 5,160 light sensors. So these are 10-inch basketball size photomultipliers. And they are equipped. They are, of course, put in a pressure vessel of glass. And they are equipped with electronics. And the electronics transforms the light signal into digital signals. And these digital signals are sent straight to your computer, wherever you are, like to this one. So if you could go in the detector, it would look like this. So you would see a kilometers long string with 60 photomultipliers, one every 17 meters. If you go 125 meters away, you will find another string, and then 125 meters away, another one. And 86 of these strings form the detector. Now, so I won't spend too much time on it, but you must, that's the beauty of this detector. You know, there's actually no detector. Each of these photomultipliers, whenever it detects light, it tells you in a digital form how many photons it sees and at what time, digitizes that picture, puts an absolute timestamp on it, and sends it to the computers at the surface. And these computers detect continuously all these light signals and put them together in neutrino events. So I'm a theorist, so you may wonder whether this is real by now. So that's a picture. You deploy strings in December and January, it's too cold otherwise. And so you see here 20 cables were deployed. They go through this pipe here into this two-story building, and this two-story building contains computers. Now, everybody now is, I think, asking the question, how do you put this in the ice? That was actually the hardest part, and that's where we actually are very proud of this idea. So here is a movie. So the first 90 meters is snow, so you just melt it. Then comes in what we call the hot water drill, and so it's a nozzle that just puts out boiling water under pressure, and it falls by gravity and melts its way, so there's no hole. It changes water into ice. And after 2 days, you have a pipe in which you can deploy photomultipliers of liquid water. And so this takes about 5 megawatts. It's about 40 car wash heaters, that's what it is. And so you see the whole system is like a circus train. It's deployed on sleds, and that's the drill tower. This is a 2.5 kilometer hose It's built near Padua. It's actually a marvel of technology, this thing. It's about that big, and it can hang over 2.5 kilometers without collapsing. And here you see the generators that, by normal fuel, drive the 40 car wash heaters that provide the 4.8 megawatt. And so after 2 days, your drill comes out, and ice is an insulator so that water remains liquid for hours. So we build it so that the hole lasts like 30 hours. And so then you move on, but waiting are these boxes, and they contain the 60 optical modules. And so they will be deployed, as you will see in the next frame. So these are the photomultipliers in their pressure vessels. So this is the cable. This is the cable where you bring down the high voltage, but also bring back up the digital signals. You see, when you are at module number 60, there is a 600-pound weight at the bottom. You let the string drop to the bottom and wait until the ice freezes and you take data. That's the idea. And so, back to the physics. Now, so if you didn't get it yet, this is a muon entering the detector. This is the light it emits, the Cherenkov radiation. And you see, this is the response. Each of these black dots is a light sensor, and you can, with your eye, reconstruct the direction of the muon. So the detector sees neutrinos produced in the atmosphere all over the Earth. It detects muons, cosmic ray muons, coming from the back, from the southern hemisphere. And so I will show you a movie. This is the detector detecting muon tracks. Remember, it collects these signals and makes them into tracks. And you see the movie repeats. At some point, you see this dramatic muon bundle come through, made by a very energetic cosmic ray. This movie is 10 milliseconds long. And so the bottom line is that we detect 100 billion muons every year, 3,000 per second, 100,000 atmospheric neutrinos per year, one every 6 minutes. It's now more like one every 5 minutes. And I'll give you the answer. We see in this mess, we detect 120 muon neutrinos per year. And so how did we manage to do this? So we did it the way Markov told us. Here is a picture of an event. Remember, so each of the dots, you cannot actually see the dots, are light sensors. And here you see the response. This is a muon track that comes from 11 degrees below the horizon. So it comes through the Earth, near the horizon. And it enters your detector here. And you see the color. You follow the rainbow. So it comes indeed, unlike the previous one, it comes through the Earth. It's a neutrino. The demarcation line was 100 TeV. So here, this, remember, we can measure energy. This, the energy of this event is 2,600 TeV. And so this is typically the event that represents a 5-sigma discovery with one event. It's actually only 4.6, but. this muon lost energy before it entered your detector and carried energy out. So its real energy is much higher than that. So the neutrino has an energy of somewhere between 5 and 10,000 TeV. And so we actually recently discovered an event that has twice the energy of this one. That is 5 sigma. What you saw is exactly the picture that, so we saw a muon neutrino, and we saw the muon go through the detector. In fact, with about 3 years of data, we have we had discovered 550 cosmic neutrinos in a background of 340,000. And so I don't show the data, you only the blue is the atmospheric background, which of course we not only detect, we can calculate and extrapolate. And you see the data, this is the usual, this is actually an event bin, number of events per neutrino energy. And here you see the actual data. The event I just showed you is this one. And so remember e to the minus 2, it's actually e to the minus 2.19 in this plot. And so what you see is exactly this, right? The atmospheric neutrino flux, and then at 100 TeV, the deviation, the flat spectrum. So this is actually not how we discovered cosmic neutrinos. We went on a tangent that we kind of knew about. It was not a surprise. But what happened is that we found two events. One of them was this one. And you know, every Thursday, the people in the collaboration get together on the phone. And this goes on for hours. And everybody sits in their office doing email. And because this is incredibly boring. And so I remember when someone from our collaborators in Japan showed this event, and I knew instantly we had discovered cosmic neutrinos because I'm an optimist. But what I mean is that this event, you know, you can tell it's contained in the detector. It's a total absorption calorimeter. And with the training we had by then, I could tell from the size of the event, this is 1,000 TeV, not 100 TeV. And you say, well, there's no muon track. No, there is no muon track. That is because this is an electron neutrino. So the neutrino makes, instead of a muon, an electron. And an electron showers in the ice. It makes an electromagnetic shower, which is about the size from here to the wall. And so a shower that big in a kilometer cube detector is a point source of light. And so this, So it's like you turn on a light bulb in your detector. And that's what you saw. You just, this totally spherically symmetric light pool. And so I superimposed this event on the data center, which is in Madison, Wisconsin, just to reset a scale. This is the lake, by the way, Lake Mendota. You should come if you haven't been there. So in Oxford, this would be about the size of 5-6 city blocks. And this is important because 300 sensors reported light in this event. So we see about 100,000 photoelectrons, and we know where each of these is to 2 nanoseconds, which is about that much. So with this information, you can actually reconstruct the direction of the neutrino, not just its energy. And so this is a simulation of the event. And you see it's totally symmetric because it's red here, yellow there, now yellow here, blue there, green. Remember, the color is the time of the photons. So this neutrino came from here, and so the photons reach your detectors first there, then in the back. And so from that information, you can reconstruct the direction, not as well as the muons. So we found two of those events when we were looking for something totally different. Pure serendipity. And so, but now you got the idea, use the experiment as a, as a calorimeter. And just look at events that interact inside the detector, like this one. We had 2 years of data, and I remember, you know, there was this discussion that went on forever. Have we discovered cosmic neutrinos or not? We decided we had not. But so you go through the 2 years of data, and see if you can find more of these events that interact inside the detector. we found 26 more, and then we published. We actually, I should tell you that since 1990, when we start thinking about that, we were actually using neural nets to separate backgrounds from signal. We were doing what's now called artificial intelligence, boosted decision tree, everything you want. And that's how we actually separate neutrinos from the signal. And so I won't go in how we do this analysis, but at some point, a graduate student in Madison pointed out to us that to see the signal, you just had to plot the data. And so in this plot, you see the vertical axis is the number of events. Now, we have a veto region so that no light comes in the detector to make sure that the light comes from a neutrino that interacts inside the detector. So this tells you how many photons come inside the detector, and the answer has to be zero. And this tells you the number of photons in the event. So this is high energy, this is low energy. So you want to be somewhere on this side of the plot. And if you look, there is the signal. And this is only 1 year of data. We have 10 years, every year looks the same. And so, but after 2 years, we finally discovered cosmic neutrinos and published in 2013. So the question was, by the way, it was another graduate student who was, of course, still looking for muon neutrinos coming through the Earth. And we only beat him by a few months. He also discovered cosmic neutrinos independently. Are these two methods consistent? And the answer is yes. Here is the flux we observe. This is, again, this E square flux plot as a function of energy. And you see here, that's the cosmic neutrino flux. This measurement, the data points, are actually the measurements of the shower events that I talked about last. So they are electron and tau neutrinos. And so the pink is the spectrum measured with the muons coming through the Earth. And you see these are totally compatible. So this actually assumes, now you know neutrinos oscillate, so if we detect sources way beyond the sun, by the time they arrive at ice cube, they come in equal flavors, as many nu e, nu mu, nu tau. And so we make this triangle diagrams that tells you the fraction of nu tau, so this is all nu tau, the fraction of nu mu, so this is all nu mu, this is all nu tau, all nu mu, all nu e. Oops, let me go back one. So you expect in this plot to end up in the center of gravity, and this is where we are at the moment. And so we are actually doing, despite what I said, we are doing oscillation measurements, but not at 1 GeV, at a million times higher energy, and sadly finding the same good result. However, you notice that these error bars are pathetic. And so you actually want to do this measurement. I'm going to spend 5 minutes on particle physics. I cannot resist it. And then I'll come back to looking for things in the sky. So you have to end up here in this diagram. But you know, we don't really know what a beam dump is like. So if you imagine all possible beam dumps and use standard trineutrino flavor oscillations, you can compute that you have to end up in this diagram in this triangle. That even allows for the neutrinos to decay, which they may or may not, from where we are detecting them. So the interesting thing is, if we can do this measurement and we don't end up in this triangle anywhere else in the big triangle, we have discovered new neutrino physics, which is really why everybody these days is doing neutrino experiments. And we actually are in the middle of building an experiment that can measure this measurement probably even a little bit better than this green ellipse that you see there. But the way we are doing this is, we started this actually a long time ago. We are putting strings inside IceCube to create a detector in the bottom center that is more instrumented and that becomes a respectable neutrino detector, not just a telescope. And so this measurement has these pathetic error bars because these events look like this. Compare that to the events I just showed you that we really can reconstruct. But with what we are going to deploy in 2 years, this event will look like that. And that will allow us to do this measurement. And I think it's very interesting. By the way, about tau neutrinos, you know, tau neutrinos were discovered at Fermilab a long time ago. And the way you discover them is the tau, you make a tau neutrino comes in, it makes a tau, and the tau decays. And so it lives about 1 millimeter at Fermilab. And so with an emulsion, you can actually see it interact, and you can see the tau it produces decay. Well, this is a lifetime. A lifetime is linear in energy. So at 1,000 TeV, this millimeter becomes 50 meters. And so you saw that we actually have separated nu e from nu tau in this triangle. So we looked through the data and said there must be some tau events. And this is what a tau, this is not the event. this is what a tau event should look like. You see it in tau interacts here. The tau then lives 50 meters and decays. And so indeed, we found one real event, one candidate event. And so here you see the event. Oops. And you cannot really, it's a tau that lives 17 meters, which we certainly can tell. And you can see, you cannot see it in this display, but go and look, for instance, at this particular digital optical module. You see here in this photomultiplier, here you see it first detects the photons that are made when the tau interacts. And these are the photons when the tau decays. And you know, you can do this in every of these pictures. So the other interesting thing is the atmospheric nu taus, of course, the atmosphere doesn't make nu taus of this energy. So this event, again, is an independent discovery of cosmic neutrinos. Now, I cannot resist showing you this event. This is of no interest to astronomy, but I, you know, among a particle physics audience. This is an event that interacts slightly outside the detector, but it's so big that you can reconstruct it. And in fact, what it is, it's, I told you, the neutrinos only interact with the nuclei. There's an exception to that. When an electron neutrino interacts with an atomic electron, it can make a real W, 80 GeV, CERN W, and then decay into two jets. This was actually proposed as a way to look for the W by Glashow in 1959, when he was a postdoc of Niels Bohr in Copenhagen. And so what it looks like is, this is the cross-section for neutrinos as a function of energy. And so when you come to this W production mechanism, you have an increased probability. And so you can glow and look of these events, but they only exist at that one particular energy. And so this is the reconstruction of the energy of this event. And we got all excited. You know why? Our energy calibration was correct. So we're 35 years, 36 late to discover the W. Back to astronomy. So this is 1 year of data. And, not yet. This is 1 year of data. And you see there are 138,000 neutrinos. And in this map, I can tell you there are 120 cosmic neutrinos, muon. This is just the muon neutrinos. You see a structure in this map that has to do with the fact that the Earth is more transparent to neutrinos here than there. These neutrinos already don't come through the Earth at these energies. So we use this to measure the neutrino cross-section and unfortunately find the right answer. And so you cannot, first of all, you don't see the galaxy. But you say you're mostly looking at background. So let me select just the high energy neutrinos. And you come to the same conclusion. We don't see our galaxy. This was a big surprise. You're first supposed to see the nearby accelerators and then the ones far away. And so we have now 10 years of data and something exciting happens. For the first time, we have actually evidence that this map is not totally symmetric. And then you ask, it's a 3.2 sigma effect, and so it's not a discovery, but you ask, why does this happen? It is because four sources stick out of this map. And the biggest one is NGC 1068, the second one is TXS 0506, etc. And so this is the first hope, actually, that by more data, we are working very hard on improving our angular resolution, which is like half degree or so, to try to find these sources. But in any case, let me conclude where we are now. So we have a diffuse flux with some evidence for sources. We cannot see our galaxy. And the first question I'm going to ask, I told you there is, for every 1,000 TeV neutrino, there is 1,000 TeV gamma ray that nobody has ever seen. But you can already guess why this is. We didn't lay awake at night about this. This is the slide, right? There is a pi zero for the pi plus that makes these neutrino events. And so really what this source is doing, it's emitting pi zeros and gamma rays at the same time that it emits pi pluses and neutrinos. And you know, the balance, remember, it's called isospin. You cannot change the ratio between pi zeros and pi plus, pi minus. And, but you know the answer, these gamma rays don't get here, at least not with their energy. They interact with the microwave background, but then the picture doesn't stop. These electrons and positrons will radiate, and the photons will interact again, and this is QED. We know how to compute this. So you develop an electromagnetic shower in the microwave photon background, and so these gamma rays arrive here with GV energy. Not 1,000 TeV energy. And so you can calculate how many gamma rays come out of this process. So here is the neutrino data at a very early stage. This was the first time Marcus Ahlers, actually, I saw him make this plot. And so here is the fit to our early data. And so what you do is you say, I have the same number of gamma rays. And then you dump them in the microwave background on the computer, and you see what comes out. What comes out is this, you see? And we have an instrument, a satellite, that detects these gamma rays. And what it sees is exactly what you predict. Exactly mean to a factor two or so, it depends, you know, I can play with this calculation. I can do all kinds of things. I can, you know, extrapolate it or model it in different ways. But the conclusion is that the energy in the universe in neutrinos and gamma rays is the same, up to a factor. Actually, I bet my wallet that the energy in neutrinos is higher. And there's evidence in the data, but I won't go into that. And that came, of course, as a shock because astronomers and had ignored cosmic rays as some exotic phenomena that didn't play a role in the universe. That's not, cannot be done anymore. So, this is a picture of the Fermi satellite. And so, I remind you, it's a photon detector built at SLAC, it's flying above the atmosphere. So remember, the advantage astronomers have, they know what they are looking at. And so you may think at this point we are looking at the same objects. And so what do they see? Well, they see something called blazars. And these are kind of like the seagulls of the universe. You know, you see them everywhere these days, and they cannot, you want to get rid of them to see more interesting birds. But blazars are where this jet is actually pointing at the Earth, the jet of the black holes, rotating black holes I described before. And so we looked whether our neutrinos correlated to the detection, to the directions of the blazars, and the answer was no. And so, in desperation, in 2016, I challenge you to try any combination of astronomical sources with cosmic neutrinos that we didn't try out during those years. And so, in desperation, what we started to do, I won't go through this slide, but when we reconstructed the high-energy neutrino, we actually just sent the data to the astronomical community in less than a minute. And this is frightening, you know, because you're sending your data to the world, and each time it happens, you get a message on your phone. There's nothing you can do. It's a strange feeling. And we did this the 10 times we did this, we send out this telegram on the 17th of September, the 22nd of September 1917, and it's a 290 TeV neutrino, so probably cosmic, that, I have a picture of it, that came from the general direction of Orion. In fact, the right shoulder of Orion, if someone can relate to that. This is the event, and after a few days, the Fermi people realized that in that direction, within 0.06 degrees, there was one of these blazars, and that blazar had increased its output by a factor 7 in the last few months. So it was somehow doing something. And that has a probability of being an accident of 1 in 1,000. And as many of you know, these things happen all the time. Not every day, but, you know, it's interesting, but that's all it is. It's what happened afterwards that made this interesting. A gamma ray telescope in La Palma, MAGIC, was looking at this object, and it discovered 100 TeV gamma rays. We didn't know it then, it was GeV gamma rays, but given the distance of the source, it are really very, I said 100, it detected TeV gamma rays. So that made it more interesting, more unusual. This is MAGIC, It uses the atmosphere to detect gamma rays like we use ice to detect neutrinos. By the way, we had no idea whether any astronomical telescope ever looked at our events. But here we got the answer. There were actually at some point 22 telescopes pointing in this direction. SWIFT detected it first. Here is MAGIC, there is Fermi. And there you see all these other telescopes. What they were trying to do is detect the galaxy and detect the distance, with the hope it's a very nearby galaxy will add to the evidence. Well, you had to wait, because the galaxy was so bright you couldn't see the absorption lines. And after months, they detected this galaxy is 4 billion light years away, so 1.7 gigaparsec. So there are similar galaxies 10 times closer that look the same to astronomers. And so we not only see our own galaxy, we don't see the nearby galaxies. We see them farther away. So the plot thickens. And so here is the good news. That's the story up to now, summarized. But we keep all our data. We have all our raw data since the detector started operating on disk. And so we can now, you have an interesting direction, you can go and look in that direction in your old data. 9.5 years of it. And here is the answer. This is the beginning of the running of the detector. And this, by the way, you're probably looking at the wrong thing. This is what I've been talking about here on the right-hand side of the plot. It's one neutrino with a little bit of other lower energy ones. But this is what we discovered in 2014. Not discovered, found. And so this had produced 13 neutrinos, 19 on a background of less than 6, in 3 months. No theorist had ever predicted such a thing. And so what happens is that, as you see, it's right on top of the source. We actually have enough events to measure the spectrum, e to the minus 2.1. And as you use a prescription that's published to look through data, despite all the statistics you can discuss about this, the probability that this is a fluctuation is a few times 10 to the minus 5. So this is real, forget all the rest. And so this source, in case I hadn't mentioned it yet, is labeled TXS0506. You heard that before. Here it is. So this burst makes this source stick out in a map that doesn't take time into account. So let's summarize. We finally discovered the cosmic ray accelerator. It's a blazar, allegedly. And so this blazar was studied by all these telescopes. So here you see the spectrum. It's an incredible spectrum. It's one of the best measured blazars now. But it also has, we know that there are neutrinos produced. And so I kind of enjoyed this. Some of you, if you're old enough, this is Kabibo at the time CP violation was discovered. And these are the theorists studying weak interactions. In fact, when we discovered the famous neutrino, theorists started trying to use blazar models. They were well known to how to produce the gamma rays. And they couldn't get one neutrino. And while they were telling me this, I knew it produced 30 neutrinos in 3 months, a few years before. And so that was the 2014 burst blew up the theory of blazars. So two possibilities. Everybody tried to do crazy modeling. And I'm proud of this. Alec Arandish and I published a paper that this couldn't be a blazar. And in fact, if they had paid attention, This jet had some weird structure, and this was known. And so what I want to remind you of, I mean, what's the big deal? Of course, it produced neutrinos and no photons, whereas the first event produced one neutrino and a lot of photons. But so this accelerator, at this time, the accelerator was like CERN, where you get neutrinos and no gamma rays in the beam. And so here were our observations. First of all, if every blazar Fermi sees produces this once in 10 years, these 30 neutrinos, and all the blazars did this, we would overproduce our diffuse flux, which we know and love, by a factor 20. So it had to be a special source. The other thing is that if anything produces 30 neutrinos in 3 months, its target is like the CERN target. It's like a block of steel, you know, not quite. But the photons don't get out, which is consistent with the data. In fact, a few photons can get out, which we can understand. So the conclusion was, this is like a blazar. It's a jet. It's a rotating black hole. But there must be something throwing a target into the blazar. And of course, it was subsequently discovered that this galaxy, TXS, is merging with another galaxy. And so now the problem is solved. Either the two jets can entangle and you get more light to interact with, or more likely, the jets interact with the thick accretion disk of matter that fills up between the two black holes that merging. So the problem from unsolvable becomes trivial. People had pointed out that if you looked at the radio data, this event actually came on the peak in the radio data. Suddenly the radio telescopes came in the game. And this is interesting because the highest energy alert we ever got is a 300 TeV neutrino that came during the Cosmic Ray Conference in Madison last summer. And in fact, if you look at the radio, it points at a so-called blazar at the peak of a radio burst, probably a merger again. And in fact, ALMA discovered that the highest source in our map at the moment, this galaxy NGC 1068, is also merging with something and producing neutrinos because of it. I'm going to finish by not telling you, about the fact that, of course, we are working very hard to combine our data with LIGO. We have been doing this since before they discovered black hole mergers. And so we continue to do this. I could give you a long lecture. And the conclusion would be that we maybe can see neutrinos from neutron star mergers now, but we'll certainly do it with a next generation experiment. So let me conclude, and that's easy. The important thing to learn from this talk is that neutrino astronomy exists. We have the methods to do it. But when you follow this talk, it's clear we don't have enough events and we have only one telescope. And you cannot do astronomy that way. We need better angular resolution, bigger detectors. We are starting the process of building a detector that's 10 times ice cube. And there is a detector being built in Lake Baikal that this spring, if everything goes well, will reach a size where they can see the diffuse flux I've been talking about. And there is a detector being developed in the Mediterranean, KM3NET. It just deployed its structure on the bottom of the ocean, which will reach eventually ice cube size and eventually larger detector. Thank you for your attention.